This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sunday is Easter, the day Christians commemorate the resurrection of Jesus Christ after his crucifixion. My guest, John Dominic Crossan, is an expert on the historical Jesus. His new book is called Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography. He writes about Jesus as a man, a Mediterranean Jewish peasant who preached equality. Crossan uses the tools of anthropology, history, and literary criticism to reconstruct the life of Jesus. As you can guess, Crossan's work is controversial. Crossan is a professor of biblical studies at DePaul University in Chicago and a former priest. He co-founded the Jesus Seminar, a group of scholars who debate what Jesus really said and did. I asked Crossan what it means to look at Jesus historically.
The basic distinction, Terry, is between the canonical Jesus, which is the Jesus you'd get if you just read through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and get a general sense of who this person is. If you raise historical questions, you begin by asking, how come there's four Gospels if there was only one Jesus? Isn't that at least three too many? Why do you need four different accounts of one life? They raise for us the historical issue. They tell us, in a sense, that they are not simply giving us the facts. They're giving us good news, and they're quite open and honest about it, and I have no problem with that. But that raises for us the question, can we go back through those Gospels to see what we would have seen if we were there in the 20s or the first century?
Now, I think there are things that history really can't explain, only faith can. For example, the virgin birth. How do you examine that historically?
Let me take that as a very, very good example. As a historian, I'm looking at two texts now. There is a story in Suetonius, the pagan Roman historian, who tells us that the night that Augustus, the emperor at the time that Jesus was born, the night he was conceived, his mother Atzia went to the temple of Apollo, fell asleep during the service and stayed there overnight, and the god Apollo impregnated her, and the child conceived, of course, was Augustus, or later to be Augustus. And that same night, her husband Octavius dreamt that he saw the sun rising from his wife's womb. Now, that is a story. I then look over at the story in Luke, and I find Mary is overshadowed by the Holy Spirit, and in Matthew that the husband, Joseph, has a dream about the child to be born being the Savior. I have two stories. As a historian, I do not accept either of those as factual, actual, biological stories. I don't think either of them happened, if you could have been there, as it were, to have observed. But as a Christian, I am challenged to ask, in which of those stories do I find a dramatic visualization of God? Do I find God over on the Palatine Palace with power, with domination from the top down with the Emperor Augustus? Or do I find God in a peasant child born in a peasant stable, empowerment from the bottom upwards? And I have not the slightest hesitation in answering where I find God. I find God in Jesus, not Augustus. But that is an act of faith, not a statement of fact. If I was a Roman aristocrat, of course, I would be happy to find God glowing on Augustus. That's the difference between history and faith.
And
between story and history, too.
So in your faith, what do you make of the virgin birth? Do you see it as just a metaphor, or do you think that there was a miracle that happened?
The only word I would be nervous about is just a metaphor, because for me, metaphors are the...
Right.
I'm not picking on your words. Metaphors for me are what we live and die for. Metaphors are the ultimate meaning of life. They are our most profound interpretation. So yes, I do consider it a metaphor. No, I do not consider the biological statement about either Atzia or Mary. They are creedal statements, statements of faith about where you find God.
Do you assume that Joseph was the father of Jesus, since you don't believe that, since you believe that the virgin birth is metaphor, not historical fact?
Yes, I would presume that Mary and Joseph, we know of six siblings, four brothers of Jesus and two sisters. They don't name them, so we only know there's plural, there could have been more. But Jesus was one of at least seven siblings. If the virgin birth is taken literally, then of course he had to be the firstborn. If not, then he could easily have been the youngest for all we know. So I consider we're dealing with a peasant family with seven children, and I presume that Mary and Joseph are the parents.
Now, what would you say to why the story of virgin birth developed?
Well, for example, that case I gave you from Suetonius is the clearest example to me. There's a certain in-your-face, Caesar, about it. if, after all, Caesar is claiming to be born of a human mother and a divine father, and that would not seem incredulous to the pagans, now we're claiming that our Jesus was born in the same way. The first pagan, Celsus, in the second century, when he criticized the virgin birth, never said, that's not believable, that's incredible, that's impossible. He knew that there was lots of stories like that. He said God wouldn't bother with a peasant, in effect. Why would God bother with a peasant woman and having a son born of a peasant woman? It was the class that bothered him, not the miracle, if you will.
You know, a lot of people are afraid that if the historical authenticity of the Bible is questioned, if people ask, did it really happen? And if the answer is, well, no, it might not have, then people will have no faith, that Christianity will cease to mean anything as a religion. Do you worry about that, or do you think it's possible to have faith, even if the faith isn't something literal?
I think it's going to be necessary, because we are living increasingly in a multicultural world, and I don't say that just to be politically correct. I stand in front of a undergraduate class every September, and I can tell by the faces it's getting more and more multicultural. Underneath the multicultural layer is multicreedal layers. We are going to have to learn to live with other religions, and we cannot get away with claiming that our religion, let us say Christianity, has certain facts which never happened to any other religion. They have just myths or stories, but we have facts. That's not going to work anymore. We all base our lives on myth, the Christians just as much as everyone else.
Did you always feel that way?
I don't think so. No, I think when I started studying, I pretty much took, you know, what I'd been told as fact, and I didn't really ask this type of question I'm asking now. It took years of study, and as soon as you take the four Gospels and start to read them in parallel columns and compare them with one another and realize that one is copied from the other, you cannot help but ask these questions. So the questions are inevitable. You can close the door to them, ignore them, and sort of retire into a closet, but the questions are there, whether you want them answered or not.
Easter, which is coming up, is celebrated as the day of Christ's resurrection. Let's talk a little bit about crucifixion. This was a pretty common punishment in the time of Jesus. What was it punishment for? What kinds of people were crucified?
If you knew that Jesus had been crucified and knew nothing else about him, you'd know two things immediately. First of all, that he was lower class. And secondly, that this was some form of what was seen as subversion against the Roman order. It was not done to the upper classes, and it was not done probably just for a petty criminal or a petty robber. It was really state terrorism. It was intended to terrorize people so they would not do the same thing. So you were, in a way, hung out for everyone to see. And part of the terror of crucifixion, and part of what made it one of the three Roman supreme penalties, like being tossed to the beast, being burned alive, or being crucified, was that very often there was nothing left to bury. That's what made it a supreme penalty. It wasn't calculated simply as being more painful, because the Romans never bothered about such things. It was that it was public, it was humiliating, and above all, you would be left on the cross for the crows and the dogs and the wild animals. There might be nothing left to bury, and that was what was terrible about it.
What do you make of the resurrection?
The resurrection means for me that the power of God, which was present in Jesus but confined, say, to Lower Galilee or Judea and to those people who could come in immediate contact with him, is now available to anyone, anywhere in the world, who wishes to find God in Jesus, who believes that God is available in Jesus. It has nothing to do, as far as I am concerned, literally, with a body coming out of the tomb or a tomb being found empty, or visions, or anything else. All of those are dramatic ways of expressing it. What is the heart of resurrection for me is the experience that the power of God is now available through Jesus, untrammeled, unconfined by time or space. That is, for me, the essence of resurrection.
But what would explain the disappearance of the body?
I don't know if we have to explain the disappearance of the body, because that presumes that we are taking the stories that we have there literally.
Mm-hmm.
What what I understood happened, this is my historical reconstruction, the disciples fled, and they said they fled. I do not think they knew anything beyond the bare facts that Jesus was taken, Jesus was crucified. I don't think they were there. I don't think they were watching. I don't think the women were there watching, because the only one who tells us about the women is Mark, and Mark tells us about the women in order to show that they really did not believe. They came to anoint Jesus, even though he had told them that he was going to rise from the dead. So that I don't think any of the first followers of Jesus knew what had happened. They had fled. And their most terrible thought, their most awful thought, was that maybe nobody had buried him. And it's hard for us to realize how terrible that was in the ancient world. It's much more terrible even than it would be for us, to be left unburied, unmourned, sort of annihilated your identity as a human being. Now, the only hope would be maybe some pious Jewish person might have buried Jesus. But then by the time you get to John's account, you have a full, beautiful, magnificent, royal anointing, pounds of precious ointment, a garden tomb, than which you could not imagine a more perfect burial. I cannot take those as factual accounts because of their differences and because of their inherent apologetic threat to get Jesus properly buried. I don't think the first Christians knew what happened to the body of Jesus.
My guest is John Dominic Crossan, a professor of biblical studies at DePaul University. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the historical Jesus with John Dominic Crossan, author of Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography. I'm sure you have great admiration for Gandhi and for Martin Luther King. These are figures who we revere for the work that they did. But it's different than the relationship a Christian has with Jesus. Jesus is a figure of worship, not just a historical figure that you respect enormously for the sacrifices that he made. Where does it come in for you that Jesus is worthy of religious reverence and not just, you know, the kind of historical respect we pay to our greatest and most enlightened leaders?
I am not at all certain, Terry, that if a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King had not been in the right place at the right time, which simply wasn't where they were, that they might not be so revered as such figures. Because to say that somebody is divine means that I, as a believer, whoever this believer is, find God in this person. It's an act of faith. If enough Christians had not found God in Jesus, then Jesus would not be divine for me. It's an interactive relationship between God, this person, and a believer. So if, for example, millions of Hindus had begun to find, say, Gandhi as an incarnation of Krishna, then he would have been an incarnation of Krishna, and he could have become the incarnation of Krishna. There is no way that you and I could say that could not have happened. And had it happened, it would have been true.
So your historical research has not shaken your faith?
No. What it has helped me is to distinguish between an act of faith and a statement of fact. And that is very important to know the difference.
Tell us what the difference is to you and how that affects how you live your life.
Well, for example, if I were to take, we talked about the virgin birth a couple of times, supposing I were to say, no, that is a fact. It's a biological fact. It would be ascertainable if, for example, we had medical examinations possible at the time. Then you're saying that faith is in facts, and I do not believe faith is ever in a fact. If I said to you, I don't believe in America, you would know immediately. I'm not saying I don't believe there's landmass between Canada and Mexico. You'd know I must be saying I don't believe in America as the land of opportunity, the land of the free and the home of the brave, as the place of the future, whatever. Somehow it would be a way of seeing America. It would not be the fact of America. It would be the interpretation of America. So an act of faith for me is always an interpretation. It is really a fundamental interpretation. And it's necessary to know the difference between a fact, which should be available to anyone who has the available methods of checking it, and an interpretation, which may not be able to be proved or disproved, especially if it's an act of faith, which is fundamental interpretation.
You used to be a priest. You resigned from the priesthood in 1969.
Right.
How come you left the clergy?
Two reasons. One was I wanted to get married, which is a good reason all by itself. The other reason was I was in constant trouble for, you know, I'd been taught to think critically, and every time I did it, I was in trouble. So even if they had told me you can get married now and stay a priest, I would have left in any case. So there was two motives, really, Terry. Getting married and being able to do my own work without being in constant trouble.
So you have more freedom as a scholar than you did as a priest?
Definitely. I mean, and I recognize that. As a priest, in a way, you're both, it's hard to criticize with a collar on. And I understood that. And I thought I would be better in university. I got dispensed. I asked for permission to leave the priesthood, and that was granted to me. So I thought it would be better. I would work in a university, and then I would not confuse people by wearing a collar and saying critical things.
You write that to remove that which is radically subversive, socially revolutionary, and politically dangerous from Jesus' actions is to leave his life meaningless and his death inexplicable.
Well, thank you. That was a nice sentence. I've forgotten that one. Yes, I mean, Jesus was put to death by the authorities, and the Romans may have abused power, but they didn't waste it. So he did something that really bothered them. And to make it sound like he was a nice little kid going around, sorry, a nice person going around and patting little babies on the head and telling sweet little stories, and some inexplicable way they managed to kill him, it makes no sense of anything. What he was doing was socially subversive in the first century and probably in the 20th century. I don't know how we'd get him today, but we'd get him somehow. We'd either trivialize him or we would destroy him.
I imagine a lot of people are very upset, angry with you for saying that the Bible is not meant to be read literally but metaphorically.
My mail, which is interesting, is running about even. I expected a lot of people to disagree with me, obviously, although we've already started when we began to question the creation story, when we open the Bible and find that the world was created in 6 days and one day of rest. We've already started on this slope of asking this question, so we can't stop it. But what has surprised me very much is the number of letters I've got saying, in effect, thank you. We find it nice that we don't have to park our brains outside the church in the morning. We find it nice, this is my summary, we find it nice we don't have to mortgage either our conscience or our intelligence to be Christians. I do get almost even letters positive, and that is very surprising because usually it's the negative you get and you never get the positive.
So with Easter coming up, tell me what Easter means to you.
I cannot separate the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. I wouldn't just put all the emphasis on the death as if the life was not important. The death is, first of all, connected to the life. The life that Jesus was living as a social revolutionary, the only question in your mind was, when will they get him and where? Will it be Antipas in Galilee or will it be Pilate down in Judea? So you're waiting, in a way, for something to happen. The death makes sense against that background. It is not that Jesus goes out looking to get himself killed, but if anyone does what Jesus does, they have to be ready to die. So I put the death along with the life. Then what is extraordinary is that instead of ending it there, which is what they hoped to do, it continued. If no Christian had ever written anything for the first 100 years after Jesus' death, we would have Josephus, the Jewish historian, and Tacitus, the pagan Roman historian, telling us three things. There was a movement over there in Judea. We officially executed its founder, but it continued. Josephus says those who loved him before continued to love him afterwards. Tacitus says with a marvelous sneer on his face, the disease broke out again and spread all the way to Rome, where everything rotten comes eventually. Now, those three things, movement, execution, continuation, those are the raw data of history that can be seen from an outsider. That really is, from an outsider, what Easter is about. From the insider, then, it's up to them to explain in their own language how come they still believe in Jesus, even though he was put to death, even though he was executed. And that belief is the resurrection.
In other words, that belief is what keeps Jesus alive.
That's what keeps Jesus alive. Put in the simplest language, nobody believes Jesus is dead and gone forever. And that could have happened in the first century. That is why I have tremendous awe for the faith of the first Christians, and I don't like to see it trivialized as if they had a terrible day on Friday, and then it was all solved by Sunday afternoon. Sunday afternoon, Easter Sunday, is the condensation, as it were, of 3, 4, 5, I don't know how many years of anguish, agony, and faith.
Will you be in church on Sunday?
Will I be in church on Sunday? No.
You won't be?
No. When I left the priesthood in 69, I really had two choices. I'd been in a religious order and spending, you know, maybe 5 hours of every day in church. I sort of prorated that over the rest of my life and figured I was ahead. But I think what I had to do seriously was I really had to stay away from the hierarchy of the church, or I was going to get trapped in negativity, spend my life opposing them. And so I really decided, okay, I'm going to be a scholar. And to be honest with you, I don't think I know the difference between prayer and study at this stage. The only way God gets at me is when I study. That's what changes me. Prayer doesn't work for me in that sense. If prayer, by the way, means letting God change you rather than telling God what's going on. So I find, no, I don't need it. I'm better off without it because I just get mad. I'd be annoyed at the sermons. I'd be annoyed at this. I'd be annoyed at that. And I'd be spending my life trapped in their program. I don't find myself in the least bit angry, by the way, at anyone. I moved out of the priesthood into the university, and I've been particularly happy. And so I'm not doing it because I'm mad. But the price of staying not mad is to stay away from the hierarchy, but stay close to the tradition. I feel very, very close to the Catholic tradition, and I probably could no more not be a Catholic than I could not be Irish. I mean, I could change the documentation, you know, but it wouldn't change me. So in that sense, no, I deliberately find it better to stay away from the official church.
John Dominic Crossan is a professor of biblical studies at DePaul University and author of Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.